Hello and welcome to another episode of It Depends. This week, we are talking about continuing our conversation around DevOps, talking about Docker and Ansible configuration management and containers and how we deploy apps across multiple systems without pulling all of our hair out. My name is Ben Robin, and I'm here today with Jesse Brown.
Hey, guys.
Jesse, tell us what Docker is.
Yeah, so Docker is not a virtualized environment, to start off with. Most people like to call it, it's like a VM. People refer to them like VMs, and that's fine because that's sort of what people are used to. But it is like OS. It is like OS, like process, like kernel sharing. So basically, it's a Linux-only sort of feature. You can use them on Windows, but it's really using like the Linux kernel beneath and things like that. But every container, as they're called, you used to kind of like virtual machine. So every container has its own user space, which means that you can run like, you can have a host be Ubuntu, and you can have one of your containers be like CentOS, and you can run your app in those containers.
We're also here with Keith Maddox.
Hello.
Keith, tell us about Ansible. What is Ansible?
Ansible is a configuration tool to help you basically scaffold out your environment with different scripts and stuff. So you can run different apt-get commands. You can install a runtime or whatever via things like Vagrant or VirtualBox and things like that. It can be used for deployment and also keeping your local development environment configured.
And finally, we have David Mo Mohundro.
Hello, how are you?
Mo, let's take a 40,000-foot step up and just talk about continuous deployment and why we want to focus on that as a value.
40,000 feet. Continuous deployment.
Because these would be sort of contained under that.
Yeah,
broad
yeah.
Heading,
so this wouldn't necessarily just be application. It's really about sort of version controlling an environment.
Right.
So, for example, with, you know, Docker, it's getting the pieces of the system that the app needs to run on. It's not just the code, but it's also the dependencies around that. With Ansible, then that would be the dependencies that, you know, you're configuring an actual machine at that point. And
right.
So it's really about, it's the whole, it's avoiding things like Snowflake servers. That's a concept, I believe, from Martin Fowler. And, you know, every Snowflake is unique and pure and different from all the others. You're unique and special. You don't want that feature with your servers.
Yeah.
You want reproducibility. You want to be able to say for certain what the state of the server is, and by moving that, exactly, consistency, moving that into version control.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a big part of it for me is all of these are centered around, like, you know, code or scripts as documentation
for
the environment.
Yeah.
So you can watch how your environment has changed over the years as you add and remove services and change the way things work. You move from one distro to another because of, you know, whatever reason, and you install Redis one day, and then you decide to use like Memcache. Like, all your dependencies are tracked over time, and it really allows you to see the complexity of your system.
Right.
Where before you just sort of throw it over the wall to IT and be like, well, I need a web server. They're like, cool. And you're like, well, it does need like, you know, Apache on it. And then you're like, okay, what else does it need?
Which version?
Yeah. And then I need eight of them. And then right. Every one of those eight are just slightly different because they had another IT guy do it.
And they talk to a database server.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I'm running on this version of Postgres. I'm on this one.
Yeah.
Well,
suddenly
it
staging
works,
has one version, production
except
has
for
another.
This one edge case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, do you just hope that everything is good? Because that has happened in the past.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, that's fine. And then, we patched this environment over here. Maybe you at best have a patch log, you know, where it's like, or maybe an email that goes out, hey, I patched the systems. Which ones and with what? And
right.
Yeah. So versus, you know, no, I can look back and see in Git history here. This is all the things that happened. And that doesn't mean that the other audits aren't good, too. But it's just you can roll back to the environment at that point.
Yeah. Every stage sort of has a, you know, unique identifier so that you can go back to it. So if you suddenly have a rollout of production and you know, you have patch day and, you know, 50 of your 100 nodes go down, like you can just bring those 50 back up with the old one and then, you know, try to reproduce exactly. that in a lower, yeah. less dangerous yeah. environment, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me as a developer, when I think about sort of the one of the higher level benefits is the isolation of the history, that I can identify what changed and therefore hopefully what broke. If something goes mm-hmm. wrong, I can quickly identify, yep. oh, well, the server in production is different than the one I'm looking at locally or yeah. something like that.
Yeah, and another benefit, too, like Jesse was saying, if you have, oh, I need 8 of those, it's, oh, one of them blows up. You yep. can quickly mm-hmm. get another server spun up. Mm-hmm. Or even just for scalability, it's like, we need 8, now we need 16.
Yeah, because even historically, if you had like a huge, you know, infrastructure, like at a colo facility,
yeah.
You might spin up like 4 web servers anticipating traffic or something like that. And then one day, you know, you end up hitting Hacker News or something, and now you've got a bunch of requests coming in. Well, spinning up, even if you have the hardware capability for like another like 4 web servers, takes like hours or days.
Yeah.
If you're clicking through, you know, installation, you know, of Ubuntu and like, you know, I mean, yeah, people have images, base images to start with and have for years, but everything after that has historically been in some document somewhere as yeah. opposed to like in an Ansible
at least in my
script you can run.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean, the type of places that we've, you know, worked with and tried to help automate, like that's just... Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, and so now, like you said, with a Docker image or Ansible, at least you can just, like, you know, can spin up the base image, and then you can run your Ansible script to bring it up to par and then put it in the, right. you know, in the load balancer. And it hopefully takes minutes or seconds yeah, instead yeah. of that. And you've got a lot of tools. We talked about Ansible. Ansible is, like, scripting. Docker and, like, the tools around Docker are more about, like, clustered swarms of... As they call them, Docker Swarm is one of the like tools around it, so that you can say, "Well, I need 8 web servers running at all times." So if a web server dies, then the manager node's kind of responsible yeah. for spinning up another container, so that you always have 8 at any given time.
Yeah. They're not entirely comparable things. So they mm-hmm. solve similar problems, but it's
right,
like
different ways. Yeah.
You know, Docker, you can containerize an application. Ansible, you can configure an app, but you're dealing with a machine at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people run Ansible from Docker.
Sure.
So Docker yeah, is like right. the virtualization technology, sort of, right? I know we said not to call it that, but but you know, you basically can say like from Ubuntu version 14.04, and then the next step you could be like run apt-get, or instead apt-get
yeah.
update, or you can make it like run, you know, curl something you download Ansible, a script mm-hmm. from like mm-hmm. your GitHub private repository or something, mm-hmm. and then the next script is to run the Ansible command.
Yeah,
so that everything sort of scripted off somewhere else, hopefully still in source control, obviously. but yeah,
some other examples together. Of yeah. this, you know, just this type of technology, Chef, mm-hmm. Puppet.
Yeah.
There's in the Windows world, there's PowerShell DSC.
Yeah, there's like
I believe.
Commandlets that Microsoft ships with,
and a lot of the ideas for a lot of these PowerShell things are to be able to run, like you said, a swarm. Like you have a cluster of machines, you want to have them all get the same change at one point.
Yeah, rolling updates, a lot of that
updates,
sort of stuff. You know,
right.
they try to solve the problems that everyone runs into at some point. You know, you don't want to take down your 30 web servers at the same time and update them. You want to roll through, you know, maybe 2 at a time. Mm-hmm, and if mm-hmm, and after an update's happened, if you've got some sort of health check that you can run
yeah.
on it, just to make sure that it's at least appears smoke right. test, you know, that it worked out. And if it didn't, then you can stop the update process and leave those out of the load balancer. And maybe spin up 2 more and leave those there so you can look at them
right.
later to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
So all these tools are sort of built to help these situations that people have learned over the years.
Yeah, and the alternative to these technologies you talked about, especially the orchestration
right.
standpoint with the Docker Swarm and things like that, things like Kubernetes and
mm-hmm.
Other OpenShift, things like that, the complexity, the barrier to entry is a little bit higher, just in my experience. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more that you have to know going into that.
Yeah.
Those stacks, and you have to do with Docker, and even some of the, I'm sure Ansible has a comparable tool. You can use something you already know, something you already understand, the Docker ecosystem, and still be able to achieve very powerful, somewhat complex scenarios with the technology that you already have integrated.
Yeah,
and Docker, you know, we talked a little bit about virtualization. It's using like namespaces and like container groups to like you know, keep the, to contain each one of those containers, if it makes sense, from the host. So the host, that's how it gets its own like networking stack and everything. Like the Linux kernel has containers built into it. And so, you know, when you spin up a container, it can get its own network and IP addresses, and they're completely isolated via namespaces to the host. And so that's sort of how that all works. It's much like a virtual machine, but it doesn't have, it runs directly sort of on the hardware. There's no hypervisor, if you're familiar with virtualization technology at all. So that's why we're talking about hyper, you know, Docker instead of like VMs. But VMs are another way to do it. And a lot of people do VMs.
Very true.
vSphere, for instance, is like a big vendor's version of basically like, I have a bunch of hardware. I don't really care what runs on it. I want to be able to change what runs on it without thinking about it. Mm. And it basically, and I guess you've got like Azure now that you can install on premise.
Yeah.
And there's probably other cloud providers like that as well, that you can basically just download their entire cloud infrastructure and just point it at your hardware, and it'll format all your disk a certain way and just sort of take over, like, you know, making sure that the data is not all in one disk and and all that sort of stuff, and letting you float VMs and just like constantly slice up your resources in whatever way you want, you know, and not using containers.
It might be helpful to sort of, for those who may not be familiar, you almost have, I think you could say, three levels. You know, one is you've got bare metal, you have physical machines, and as you sort of scale up, if you want a new machine, you have to go buy the hardware and build it.
Right.
So then the next step is sort of virtual machines, and virtual machines work fairly well if you have a lot of hardware. Like Jesse mentioned, you have vSphere. It's like, okay, I want to make use of all the hardware I've got here, but I don't want to think about OS separation at this point.
Yeah, you want to buy giant servers. Yeah, you want to buy like three big servers instead of like 10 small servers.
Right.
Like, and so that you can slice it up to have, you know, 10 instances of the web server across those three big servers instead of having to install another server every time. You get to buy a lot of hardware in advance and slice it up through virtual machines.
So then you get a lot of the benefits there. But then you start looking at like some of the cloud options where it's like, you don't even, the hardware is,
who knows? Yeah,
you know, elastic at this point. It's so just like, you know. So there are some blurry lines between, we talked about this a little bit, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. But when you want a little bit more control, you don't really want to upload like a gig of a VM every time you deploy. Mm-hmm. If you want to package everything up, and that's where something like Docker is really beneficial. Is you've now, instead of packaging up the entire machine, you package up an application with all the things around it.
Right, basically like a definition built on the backs of everyone else setting up, like, you know, the Ubuntu core image that you use for production is quite different than like you just installing it yourself. Like people have come through and got rid of things that they don't think you need, and they're secure by default, where like, you know, nothing's exposed to the host by default. And so, you know, so I think someone mentioned before that, you know, VMs are sort of, you get everything all at once. And then if you really want to make it lean and mean, so to speak, you have to kind of go in there and turn off stuff yourself. You know, you got to configure that host and VM relationship to like trim the fat and make sure that you can't get out to the host through certain like network bridges and all that sort of stuff. Where Docker sort of starts with nothing and you build up step by step. And so it just, different ways of thinking about it, obviously different technology under the covers, but, you know, because people are starting to use cloud infrastructure, you're seeing a lot more of the latter with Docker, because you want people to, people want to start with really small, like 40 meg images instead of like, you know, 4 gigs of like, you know, an install or a 1 gig Linux install that they're, you know, uploading to every cloud provider to get redundancy, you know.
Yeah. Well, you've kind of hinted at that Docker, speaking specifically on the technology for a while, is that Docker is, in a lot of instances, faster than going the traditional VM route, because like you said, a lot of the resources, the hardware resources, are all shipped by default with the VM. Docker, you have, each container has access to all of the system resources, but they're kind of shared. And
it's another process, right? Yeah, it's just like another process on your, you know, on your machine. And so it has access to everything unless you kind of limit it, which VMs you can kind of set up that way, but then, you know, you constantly have to play the size game where you're like, oh, I suddenly need more CPU on these web servers, and you're slicing up your CPU all the time, where, you know, in Docker world, it would just sort of it would just get more resources because it needed them. And unless you really need to constrain it for some reason, then you just sort of let it do what it needs to do. And so it lets it scale a little more naturally. And VMs have ways to kind of let CPU burst and disk space burst and things like that so that you don't have to baby them. Like memory is one that we run into a lot in you know, divvying up like servers with like 128 gig of RAM. You know, it seems like a lot. And then suddenly you start putting a whole bunch of machines on it and you give them all 4 gig and you're like, well, this one's only using 2 right now. And so like, do you leave it at 4? Do you put it at 2 with like a bubble of another gig? And like with Docker, it's like, well, I know I have 128 gig of RAM. And unless I start hitting, like all I really care about is making sure I don't hit, you know, 115 gig of RAM. Like, and so you can have your quotas on like the main machine and kind of monitor it from that instead of sort of babysitting all your VMs and how they're, you know, in their daily use or whatever.
So we've been talking about the post-deployment side of things mostly so far. Once you get to the higher environment, staging and production, how these kind of tools can make your life easier, make problem solving easier. Let's talk for a second, shift the conversation to local development and what this can, what benefits there are for me as a developer in my local environment. So I'm thinking specifically of our lunch and learn yesterday is the reason for the timing of this this particular topic. And right afterwards, one of the immediate benefits I experienced personally was being able to run Ruby Rails apps on my Windows side of my Mac. So I'm on a large .NET project right now for the last couple of months. I'm booting into Windows from my Mac. Haven't been able to until recently work on some of our Rails products in that meantime. But now with Docker, we've added Docker to 2 of them, Tapkin and Illumis, and have been able to get those running on the Windows side and do development and test things out, merge PRs, that kind of thing, even in the Windows environment. So that's one of the main really tangible benefits for me as a developer locally that I've enjoyed in using Docker recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, it's convenient.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have obviously installed a virtualization technology and fired up Ubuntu and followed the same steps that are in that Docker file to get a running version of it.
Right.
It would share resources like a VM instead of like a process. Performance would be different, probably not much different in the case of what we're talking about here, because, you know, just to throw it out there, there is a hypervisor involved for Docker on Windows and Docker on OS X. You know, it is a it's just the way that it runs for those operating systems, because the kernel stuff we talked about that Docker uses is strictly like a Linux, like Ubuntu, like, you know, SUSE and CentOS. Like, it's a core Linux thing that those two OSs just don't support. So you are using some virtualization technology, but the fact that you can spin it up without having to think about all those steps individually is sort of the benefit there, right? And if someone changes it tomorrow where, you know, we're not using Postgres, we switch to MySQL, you can just run a command to kill it all and run a command to bring it back up. And now you've got a fresh environment that everyone else has. Consistency between developers is a big win. Yeah. If you've done a whole lot of different technologies, specifically something like Ruby, where like you've got to manage multiple versions of the Ruby, you know, the runtime environment, as well as like the gem sets and everything.
Oh, yeah.
These sort of put them in isolation in the other containers, so you don't have to think about, oh, you know what, I was using when I forgot to like put bundle in front of it, and so I was running. I was running a different version of Rails on this old, you know, anyway, you can just have version mismatches. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of gives you a clean slate to not have that problem. And you don't have to worry about learning RVM and all those other RBNVs, you know.
I think I spun that thing up and down multiple times, probably a dozen times yesterday, as we were trying to get various things to work on my Windows box. And one of the big differences between those two applications is that one uses like Yarn, for example, and Webpack, and the other doesn't. And so with the Docker file individually, you kind of mentioned this earlier, but it's sort of the Docker file has almost documented the commands you need to run to get the thing up and running. And so it sort of is composable in that sense across various developer machines like you were talking about.
And the benefit of both these technologies, Ansible and Docker, is that you've mentioned earlier, it's like the declutterization. Like your local host environment isn't cluttered. For example, I was running bundle install and I hadn't switched the gem set over. So it got put in my local Ruby 2.4 version. My local, a global bundle.
Yeah, all your node modules and all that stuff. From
it
Yarn.
Just got put on the global namespace, and then it's like, oh, I have to install it again because I switched gem sets. Mm-hmm. But gem sets were very helpful, talking about RVM gem sets here. I think RVNV I support from them or something similar as well. They were great because it helped keep your apps gem versions different from each other, which in a lot of some really common cases can end up causing some problems between different versions of gems, help them keep them separate. But it's easy to forget, oh, I'd have to CD back in this directory because it's not going to hit the gem set if I don't do this. And if you get all the commands, suddenly your global gem space is really cluttered. Docker and Ansible both, by putting it within either a virtualized environment or a container.
Or a container, yeah.
You have complete isolation.
Yep.
It's like a complete file system. The way that Docker specifically does their file system, they're all completely boxed in from each other. So you don't have to worry about the global namespace becoming polluted on your machine.
Yeah. After I had gotten Tapgiv running yesterday locally, I think you can just run Docker system prune. And it'll kill all of the containers, and everything just gets removed, and it reclaimed like 6 gigs or something on my machine after we had run it several times.
Yeah. Yeah, another big one for me is, like, I've worked on multiple different projects, and a lot of them use Postgres. A lot of them use slightly different versions of Postgres because they were developed at different points in time. And so, like, generally, Mo kind of alluded to it earlier, you're like, well, it probably will work fine. Like, you know, there's not too much different between them because it's my local machine, and I don't want to run 5 Postgres servers in the background every time, right? Like, I don't want to remember to shut it down so that my computer doesn't run like a dog. But, we're like, at least a Docker, like, it's just stop. You know, you're like, hey, stop these services. And then, like, now that Postgres 9.6 is stopped, and you can spin up another app that uses 9.4, and you know you're not just, like, you know, littering your system with 5 versions of Postgres and 5 versions of MySQL and, you know, all the, yeah, I mean, obviously you use disk space, but, like, that's really the only resource that, and if it's coming from a Docker file, then you can also, like Ben said, you can just prune them down, like, every once in a while. If you're working on 2 projects, then you can just kind of run those and prune everything else and then, and reclaim that space. And then if you happen to have to go on something you haven't been in 6 months, you just bring it back up and it'll be just like it was 6 months ago.
Yeah, be a responsible programmer. Don't litter your host machine.
Yeah.
I see a few, you know, really good benefits for it. One is obviously you avoid the works on my machine. Yes. It's like you don't need Jeff Atwood's works on my machine badge anymore because the environment, and this is sort of the second benefit, it looks like production.
Yep.
Since you can deploy the Docker image. If, you know, just say, for example, a Rails app, it's really, really easy to spin up Rails on Mac, on the Mac OS. But you aren't running on the exact same OS as you are in production. You have a FreeBSD-based or BSD-based
Alpine
the Mac,
or something, right?
You know, but then over on your production environment, maybe it's on Ubuntu, it might be on Heroku. Heroku uses Docker images. Like, if you're using Docker, then, you know, it's basically a turtles all the way down approach. You've got Docker here, Docker there.
Consistency.
Consistency, right?
Yep.
But what's under the bottom turtle?
It's recursive. It's a circle. I don't know.
More turtles.
Yeah. So,
but that's what's also great for, like, the cloud providers is that on the actual machines where they're running these containers, they're running, like, the smallest Linux kernel possible because – which also reduces their surface area of, like, attack and security and needing to patch. You know, there's the smaller it is, the less things you have to patch. And so, you know, having your own small containers is great because, like, just like any other machine you own, like, if you own the Docker container, you need to, you know, redeploy them sometimes. And that's why people, you'll see a lot of them have, like, apt-get update and, like, you know, run security patches, basically. But you can just kind of bring them down and bring them back up. And I'm sure for the host as well, like, they're really glad to have, like, this very tiny kernel that they can just run updates on that, you know, is basically instead of having, like, a full-blown, like, Ubuntu installation where they need to keep up to date because there might be some security vulnerability in a package that they're not really using. Mm-hmm. Obviously, cloud providers have probably been doing this for way longer than we have and pruning the systems to make sure it doesn't have anything unnecessary.
So I thought of something else, too. We talked about keeping your dev and your prod environments the same, but how often have we run into issues, even in the same environment, where something looks the same? For example, Nokogiri. It's like, oh, I brew installed this one thing over here. And it's like, once you have it in a Docker format, it will be reproducible between your dev's machines. And even in this case, you know, if we're running Docker on Windows or Docker on Mac, the Docker side of things is going to be consistent still.
Yeah.
So...
That's been a problem a lot with the compilation things you have to compile.
Yeah.
Historically, like on the Mac, like updates will break it sometimes, right? You've got like software updates where like Xcode updates, and now you got to install like the new Xcode tool chain, and like that means you need to like recompile Rails or recompile, and it's like, oh man, like it makes you not want to keep your own system updated. Because you know it's going to break all your dev stuff. So, like, you know, you don't have to worry about that if all your dev stuff's in Docker.
It's the isolation is, you know. So, it's, I suspect we will be using it more for.
More and more. Yep.
Yeah.
As we begin to kind of wrap up our conversation for today, let's mention just a few quick kind of little gotchas, maybe, like just common problems that we've experienced as we've been getting to know the technology and that other people might run into as well. So one, for example, that I'm thinking of yesterday was the server PID file that I had to delete a couple of times. And, you know, there are workarounds for that. Like, we've found several since then. But it's just kind of, as you get exposed to Docker and to these new technologies, maybe for the first time, you kind of have to learn the nuances.
Yeah, there's some learning here, right? Yeah, just like any new technology, you know, you've got a lot of little ins and outs you've got to learn. Like, Docker's not exactly like, you know, it's not super easy. I mean, it's easy once you know it, but I mean, there's a lot of steps to it. Like, if you've been installing everything on the Mac and just deploying to Heroku, like, you know, your steps to like get it running on a Docker file, like, you're going to have to like know a little bit more about Ubuntu and being able to use like apt-get. Mm-hmm. And like, you're like, I've been using Yarn and I just brew install Yarn. And you're like, well, that doesn't work on Ubuntu. Right. So like, you know, there's some learning there, but if you're familiar with, you know, Ubuntu or another distro, then like, it'll come pretty naturally. But you know, if you have been using like Windows or the Mac and Windows has the Linux subsystem now, so you can actually install Rails on there and run it there as well. It has all the same drawbacks as it does installing it on Mac though, right? Where suddenly you now have to think about RBENV inside this like Windows subsystem, Linux subsystem. And like, you know, it's not turtles all the way down. It feels weird where you're just like, oh, like I forgot. Like now I got to install like five versions of Rails to get these, you know, apps running, and has all the same problems.
And that's a good point. Not every system, if your existing dev process works for deployment or whatever, not necessarily go out and use Docker immediately. You have to, you know, evaluate the pros and cons.
Absolutely.
Does it make sense for the timing? Because like you said, there's going to be some learning curve to teach people if they don't already know about Linux, installing different tools, common gotchas within your systems. So like anything, you know, it depends, you know, make sure you know what makes sense for your use case and proceed accordingly.
I think another one with the well-isolated containers, which is a huge benefit in a lot of ways, you also have to expose the things you need. So the database host, for example, as one service depends on another, you have to identify that. You have to expose the ports on your host machine from the container.
Which is great for deployment, right? Because now you know what you need to know.
There's no assumed, like...
If you need to move from one cloud provider to another, you're like, well, I know I need to set these database URLs because like they're in my Docker file. Right. They're showing... You know, it's showing me exactly what it needs to run. And so,
there's a whole lot of things that might just work that you don't think about. It's like forces, and you sort of get the benefits of having your environment and source control now.
Yeah.
Like versus, I'll just configure it later. It's like, well, Docker, you sort of have to go through
configure
that.
Configure it now.
So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you guys for this episode on Docker and Ansible and continuous deployment type things in the realm of DevOps. This has been a good conversation. I hope it's been helpful and educational for people out there. If you want to connect with us, you can do so on Twitter at ClearFunction or hashtag ItDepends. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love for you to share this episode with somebody you know in the field.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by ClearFunction. ClearFunction is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.